This is the Decibel Geek Podcast with Chris Sanzak and Aaron Camaro. It's that special time of year, a magical time here on the Decibel Geek Podcast where I, Aaron Camaro, and my co-host Chris Sanzak, we get festive. It only comes once a year. It's July, and you know how we celebrate it here? We celebrate it with Kissmas in July. The entire month dedicated to talking about nothing but the hottest band in the land. And man, are you guys in for a treat today. Chris, I know you got to be excited for this. You set this one up, and man, I am stoked for it.
Yeah, I'm really excited for our guest today. We're going to introduce him here in a few minutes. But if you remember all the interviews with crew members we've had from the past, you know that we always have a good talk with these guys, and I think today will be no exception. So we got to take care of our business real quick.
Yeah, let's knock this out real fast. You know what we like? We like reviews, whether it's a Apple Podcast review, a Podchaser review, even a Facebook recommendation. We'll take them any way we can get them, and you're the ones that can give them to us. So let's knock this one out because it's a good one. It's an Apple Podcast review, and it's entitled Amazing Podcast. It's got all 5 stars, and it goes like this. As a fan of the Rock and Metal Combat Podcast, been listening to these guys recently, and they do not disappoint. Very entertaining. Been loving the quarantine sessions lately. Something to keep you entertained during these rough times. Aaron has a great radio voice, and guys, please try to get Lizzie Borden to do an Albums Unleashed with you guys. Man, that would be awesome. That comes to us from Eric Jordan from right here in the good old USA. A sweet podcast review from Apple. Gotta love that, right?
Yeah, I love that. Maybe we look into contacting Lizzie Borden in the future and which album would you pick to do from him?
Oh man, I'd really have to think that over because there's a handful of them that I'd love to talk to Lizzie Borden about. Maybe we just start at the beginning and get him to keep coming back for more and more and more.
I have a soft spot for Visual Lies.
Yeah, me too. That's probably my absolute favorite, but I want to know about all of them. I want to know about everything.
Sure. Yeah, and our other favorite people, Geeks of the Week, these are people that share it on Facebook. We tweeted on Twitter last week's Quarantine with a K session episode we did with Kevin Williams. And thanks, Kevin, for coming on, and it was a fun one.
Yeah, I'm super looking forward to that new album from The Swear. And, man, it's good. You guys, I can't wait for you to hear the whole thing. And check out Kevin's podcast, In Obscuria, which is awesome. If you guys dig what we're doing here, you're definitely going to dig what he's doing over there. And we had a lot of fun with Kevin last week, talked about all kinds of different Kiss stuff, laughed our butts off the whole way through the show. And people got out there, and they shared that stuff, and they retweeted it. And when they do that, they become a Geek of the Week.
And Geeks of the Week this week are Wayne Cross, Shay Hargett, Kristen Schimbeck, John Villos, Baco, Matt Porter, Grayson Gallegos, Jay Shibluski, Andrew Jacobs, Mikhail Burrell, Jessica Pone, Todd Cunningham, Craig Turdich, David Glenn, Kiss Army Omaha, Mike Parnell, In Obscuria Podcast, Kevin Williams, Sean Cullen, Aaron Baker, Joel Hoffman, Bill Elam, David Cathy, Focus on Metal, Ernesto Aguiar, and as always, even though I didn't put it on the sheet, the Mooger Fooger.
That's right. If you want to become a Geek of the Week, wait a minute, and Rockin' Ron Runyon. If you want to become Geek of the Week, all you got to do is just that. Get out there, take this week's episode, and you share it, retweet it from the original posts, and we will mention you on next week's show. You will be an honorary Geek of the Week. Man, let's get to it. I'm so excited. So, Chris, why don't you go ahead and tell everybody who we got with us.
So, today on the show, we're joined by Barry Ackham, and Barry, which we'll get in more of his history with the band, in general, was a tech for Kiss during the Zenith years, like around 76 through 78, and we've had crew guys on from the very beginning. We had Moose on, we had Pixie on from the Dynasty Tour, we had Kenny Barr on from the Revenge era, mm-hmm. But this is the first crew member from, like, kind of the glory years that I think we've ever had on. So Barry, welcome to the show.
Thank you, guys. It's actually Barry Ackham, but that's, you know, a lot of people pronounce it that way.
Well, Ace is always known for saying Ack, so I didn't know if that's where the name came from.
Hey, give me a limo pronto, or heads will roll.
Oh, I can tell we're going to have fun already. Man, Barry, how do you get this gig way back in the day when this all first starts for you? How do you even get hooked up with Kiss?
Well, you're aware of Paul Chevrier, who was Gene's tech, right? Gene Simmons' tech. Paul Chevrier was from my hometown in Van Wert, Ohio. And Paul came home in 1975. He came home during Christmas break, and it was Thanksgiving. And I ran into him, and he said, "Hey, man," he goes, "we're looking for a guitar tech for Kiss." And at that time, they were just, you know, they weren't huge, right? They were just kind of really getting ready to take off. And I said, "Well, you know, I don't know." And he goes, "Well, we need somebody right away. We've been through like 7 or 8 guys, and nobody's working out. They just don't mesh with Ace and Paul." And I said, "Well, I don't know." And he goes, "You got to tell me, and you got to give me an answer tomorrow, because you got to be in New York." And this was a Thursday. He says, "You got to be in New York by Saturday, by noon." And I said, "Well, I'll let you know tomorrow." So the next day I thought about it. And I was in a band at that time. I played bass. And I thought, well, you know, I could stay here in Van Wert and, you know, maybe make it with my band, right? Or I could go, you know, on the road and get some experience and meet some people and travel. So I, you know, it actually, at the time, it was a hard decision for me, but, you know, in hindsight, it was the best decision I ever made. Right. So the next day on a Saturday, I was in New York, and Paul Chevrolet and Zero, who was the pyrotechnician, picked me up in a station wagon. And we went to the office, which was then Rocksteady, and we picked Gene and Paul up. So I met them like, you know, like 45 minutes after I got off the plane, I was meeting Gene and Paul. I helped them put their guitars in the back of the car, and we went to a rehearsal studio, and that was it. I started setting up the amps, and, you know, because I really didn't know much about the band at the time. And that's probably what made it good for me, for them and me, was that I wasn't a huge fan. I didn't really know about their music or, you know, anything about them, really. So I just did my job. I did what I knew how to do, which was take care of the amps and the guitars and tune them and all that stuff. So that's how I got the gig.
That's awesome.
And they liked me. I got along real good with Ace right off the bat. Because he knew I knew what I was talking about. He knew that he felt comfortable with me. So that was good.
Yeah. Do you remember what the first show was that you worked for them?
God, no. I don't. It was a whirlwind. All I got to tell you is it was a whirlwind, because we did 2 weeks of rehearsals, and we had, it was when the band had just graduated from a Ryder truck, right? Opening shows, and the band had just started flying the tour before that. But prior to that, they were all riding in a station wagon, and the crew was all in a Ryder truck. So they just went to their first semi. So I got on right at the beginning. It was like getting on a rocket ship right as it's ready to take off. And I didn't know. I didn't know what was going to happen. But they got their first semi, and we got our first bus. So the crew actually got to travel on a bus. I think it was in Boston, I think, or somewhere up in the East Coast was where the first gig was. I can't remember exactly. New York, somewhere.
Was it around January 76?
Yeah, somewhere in that area.
I'm looking at a list of tours.
Nobody ever asked me that, and I never thought about it, to be honest with you.
We're super nerds, but January.
I'm going to have all the dates you guys want. You can look up the dates. I'm not going to have all the right dates, I can tell you.
No,
that.
I got you. Well, in January of 76, like you were there for the 3-night run at Cobo Hall in Detroit, right?
Oh yes. Yeah. That was something else. That sticks in my mind. That was a really good show, you know. That's kind of where I really gained a lot of respect for the band was during that show. I thought, now these guys are good, you know. We had all these cameras set up, you know. There were lots of cameras. I remember that, front of the stage and everything. And then we went back to the hotel. We were watching. We were in Ace's room, and we were watching some of the footage from the show. And of course, they had the big cameras back then. None of this GoPro stuff.
Right.
Well, those shows are kind of legendary with Kiss fans, because, I mean, and that was kind of them, they had kind of arrived with those shows, because I sell out 3 shows in Detroit, that's amazing. And so, Detroit always just seemed to be a real base for that band, like, they really got what Kiss was about, it seems.
Well, I think they broke in Detroit, you know? Yeah. I think Cleveland has been known to break a lot of bands, you know, Genesis and a whole bunch of bands broke out of Cleveland. and Detroit. Those have been known places for bands to break out. And I think Kiss were very smart. I think they knew that. And they knew that they had to go somewhere outside of their city to conquer someplace else before they could come back home. It's that old saying, you got to leave home to make it. Then you can come back home.
Right.
And that's kind of what they did. At least that's the way it played out anyway.
Yeah.
Whether it was a real plan or not, that's the way it played.
What were the guys like personality wise when you first met them? Like, I mean, were they pretty interesting right off the bat, or like, did they change over the years as fame kind of kicked in?
Yeah, they changed. They definitely changed, but the personalities were there. I mean, they were who they were. Yeah. You know, Ace never really changed. He's the only one that I could say, and Peter didn't really ever change, but Paul and Gene, you could say their ego got a little bigger as time went along. I have no problem saying that, and I'm sure that they would admit that too. But Ace was who he was. I mean, he just, here's a great story. When he was on, this was during, right after Destroyer, after the Destroyer tour ended, he was in a guitar shop somewhere in upstate New York. He walked into a guitar shop and they had an old, I don't know, 58 Les Paul, 59 Les Paul hanging on the wall. And it was hanging up real high in the store. And Ace was just had a t-shirt on and he had jeans and tennis shoes. That was it, you know? And he said, hey, can I see that guitar? I want to play that guitar up there. And the guy goes, no, sorry, man. No, you can't play it. And he goes, yeah, but there was a poster of him behind on the wall, behind the guitar. He says, well, that's me right there. And the guy goes, yeah, right, kid. Get out of here. He had a watch on. It was from Tiffany, called a Pulsar watch. A Pulsar, I think. Anyway, it was a digital watch, and it was engraved to Ace Frehley from Bill of Coin on the back of the watch. So he had to take his watch off and show it to the guy. And then the guy goes, oh, I'm sorry. And he got the guitar down and let him play it. So,
wow.
Yeah.
I bet that kind of stuff happened to those guys all the time.
Well, yeah, back then, because, see, they didn't allow anybody to take photos of them without their makeup. I was lucky they let me do it. They trusted me, you know. Gene was the most skeptical about all of the photo stuff, but you know, they always wore bandanas and, you know, they always hid their face. And Big John, he was, oh man, you did not want him to get a hold of your camera, because he flat out just threw film out of it, throw it on the ground and step on it, and then throw your camera back at you. I've seen him do that many times. But he really had a big heart. The guy was great, and it was just a show. You know, he didn't want anybody else taking pictures, so he made it evident that nobody was allowed to take pictures.
Nice. So, yeah, Big John's a good dude. I like him.
Oh, man, he's great. He was the best. I love that guy.
Our
crew was tight. The thing about it was the whole crew, Paul Chevarria, you know, Mick Campisi at the time, and Rick Monroe on lights, me on, you know, with guitar. So when I started, I took care of Ace and Paul, and we had the long guitar cords. We had like 50, 60 foot long guitar cords. So I always, in my mind, whenever I was working with them on stage, you know, Paul would run around and jump around with his guitar and stuff, and Ace would, you know, they'd cross the cords over. So I had to kind of, like, it was like having the reins on a wagon train, you know,
a
wagon horse. Because I'd have to make sure those cords didn't get tangled up, or Paul might trip with those platforms and stuff, you know. So I was relieved when we got the wireless system.
Oh, I bet. Right.
When we got the wireless guitar system, that was incredible. And I got a great story about that.
Yeah, let's hear it.
Okay. So fast forward to Love Gun, I guess, was Ben, or... So you guys will probably know this. You can look this up, but it was sometime around 70. Well, it had to be 77, I guess. Mm-hmm. And Ken Schaefer got a hold of these wireless systems. I think he developed them. If he didn't develop them, he had something to do with them. I'm pretty sure he was the guy that invented them. Him and somebody else. Anyway, he came up to, we were in Newburgh, New York, getting ready for the tour. We had a big airplane hangar in Newburgh, New York, where they set up the whole stage, the light, the sound, everything, so the band could rehearse. Because what they normally did was did two-week rehearsal in a studio in Manhattan somewhere, you know, SIR, one of those rehearsal studios, a small one, and just went through the songs they were going to do. And then they would do the, you know, the live show, you know, full stage, lights, get the lighting cues, all that stuff down. And then they would do a dress rehearsal, you know, the last couple of days before we'd gone on tour. Well, we were going to set up the, it was a perfect time to set up these wireless guitars. So we were putting these wireless things in these leather pockets and putting them on the straps and then, you know, testing them out. And they were on like UHF frequency bands. So it was like the old television bands, UHF.
Yeah.
And so anyway, we got them set up and, you know, Gene Paul and all of them had, all of them were working. All their guitars were working. And of course, now imagine you're tied to, it's like you're tied to a stake with a rope, right? And then somebody unties you.
Yeah.
And you've been playing all this time with the cord, and you could never go out to the front, stand at the soundboard, and hear what it sounded like out front. So the first thing Paul wanted to do was go out and stand at the soundboard, which is what he did.
Sure.
And Gene happened to be singing. So the first song that they did, Gene was had to sing on that particular song. I don't remember what it was, but anyway, he's singing, and Ace, of course, Ace is like, oh, I got to check this out. So Ace goes down the stairs, Paul goes down the stairs, and they disappear. You know, Paul, and all of a sudden we see Paul out at the soundboard. But then we don't see Ace. We can hear him playing. His solos are coming through the amplifier, right? Uh-huh. And Gene's looking around, and Gene does not like this fact that they're not there on stage with him. He was upset with that. Because he wanted, I think he wanted to be out there too, walking around, you know, but he had to be singing the song. So after that song was over, he came back over to me and he says, where's Ace? And I said, because you could see Paul at the board, right? Mm-hmm. And he goes, where's Ace? I said, I don't know. And he goes, find him right now. So Hawkeye and I went out looking for Ace. Now, this is a big airplane hangar, and down each side of the airplane hangar are offices, like probably about 20 all the way down the thing. So we're walking down, we're trying to find him, we think he's in one of those offices. Meanwhile, they're doing another song and the guitar is still coming, his lead parts are still coming through. His guitar parts are still coming through, right? But nobody can find him. So I said, I don't know where he's at. Hawkeye said, I don't know either. So we go back up on stage and again the song ends and Gene goes, where the fuck is Ace? Oh, I'm sorry. Am I allowed to cuss on this show?
Sure. Yes, you. Yes.
And I would say, we don't know. And he goes, find him now. And he gave us one of those monster faces, you know, that he's famous for. And he goes, find him now. So we went back, went in the bathroom again. I went in the bathroom and I thought, I wonder if he's up on the toilet, you know? Sure as shit. I got down on my hands and knees, and I looked under the toilet, and he was crouched, you know, with his feet up on the toilet, with his guitar shoved in there, all in this regular size stall, playing guitar, hiding from everybody.
That's awesome.
And that's the kind of shit he did all the time. He did stuff like that.
But he's still playing, so you know he's in the vicinity. You just don't know where the hell he's at.
Really, we didn't know because it was loud. See, it was loud coming from the PA and shit, so we couldn't tell. We couldn't hear him messing around or, you know, making any noise, obviously, yeah. But we could hear the guitar coming out of the speakers outside of the restroom, right?
Too
so
funny.
It was pretty funny.
That's hilarious.
That is awesome.
Oh, man.
Yeah, well, that story never made it into any books or anything.
No, that's funny as hell. I know that. Well, and this is a techie question. A friend of mine named Jason, who runs a KISS Facebook page, I mentioned that we were going to interview you, and he asked to get you to confirm that Gene's bass output jack was routed out in the back until the Alive 2 tour in 77 when he went wireless.
The transmitter was in the back of the guitar. It was on the strap for a while, and then in the back of the guitar. We actually put him in the guitars. What happened was, we had him on the outside on the strap in a leather pouch, and then the the wire came down from the strap and plugged in. It was hard to see it. And then we decided to try to put them in the guitars. So we put them in the guitars, but the problem with that was if one of those things fucked up or you needed to change a battery because the battery, you know, went dead, then it was too hard to get to it to change it, not during the live show. So we needed a fast way to do it. So then we put them back on the straps again because that was easier and much easier to do. And we could just change out the path. We actually had another unit that we would just slide in, plug it in, and take the other one out. But if it was in the back of the guitar, then we would have to unscrew the plate on the back and all that stuff. So
gotcha. Okay, cool. Well, I just want to make sure I asked that for him because he was like, make sure you ask him this. And I was like, I don't know if he's going to know that, but yeah, you have a good memory for that stuff.
Yeah,
well, that's what we did. You mentioned Paul Chavarria, Mick Campese, people like that. And we talked to Moose Orkento, who was with Kiss early on, and I think he left right before you came in.
He had a
bad injury, but it just from what he had told us, the crew in those early days was really like a brotherhood. I mean, because like a Kiss show, even back in those days, it was more sparse. But I have to imagine that show must have still been a very back-breaking show to put on every night.
Oh, it was. Trust me, it was. But the crew was tight. What I was going to tell you when I told you about, you know, Chavarria and Mick Campese and everybody and Hawkeye, Rick Hendrickson and me, we were all very tight, very tight. There was no rivalry or animosity. We were very close, and we helped each other out all the time. So we just all got along. And right. But we were very, very protective of the band as well, almost like secondary security guards, if you will. We took care of them, too, you know. If we were out and we were at a party or whatever with them or whatever, we watched out for them as well. Like, for example, there was a thing with Blue Oyster Cult, and we were playing Nassau Coliseum in New Jersey. I can't remember exactly when this was, but Blue Oyster Cult was opening up the show for us. And Eric Bloom was getting a little testy backstage in the hallway about how they were the ones that came up with the bombs, with the flash bombs and stuff, and with the concussion bombs that they used on stage. And they actually were the ones that first started doing that. But he was like, you know, kind of getting like testy between him and Gene, and they were kind of arguing and stuff, so we had to step in between them and just say, hey, you know, you guys just need to chill out. Doesn't really matter, you know, just do your show, because Kiss used to open up for Blue Oyster Cult. So now all of a sudden Blue Oyster Cult's opening up for them,
right? Yeah.
So but Eric's a good guy. I became good friends with Eric Bloom. He's a pretty good guy. But what I'm saying is we defended those guys fiercely, you know. We protected them. I don't know how it went on after I left, but we were a very tight crew.
And I got to imagine, too, at that time, especially, you know, Kiss is on the rise. And like you say, bands like Blue Oyster Cult, where a couple of years ago, Kiss were nobodies, and they were opening up shows that Blue Oyster Cult was the headliners on. Now, just a couple of years later, you know, BOC, they're opening for Kiss. And Kiss is one of them bands where I got to imagine pretty easily the other bands playing with them can get pissed off, even if the band don't personally do nothing to them, just by the fact of looking at them and going, were there any bands that ever really came close to, you know, big explosion fights in the back between them and Kiss?
No, not really. Well, I'd have to think about that one, but more, I can tell you more about the bands that got along with them. And those were the bands that didn't see him as threat. They didn't see him as a threat. They saw him as a music marketing machine. And that was bands like Styx and Rush and people like that. They would come up, the guy, who is it, Tommy Shaw from Styx, he'd come up and ask me about some of the business techniques, the marketing techniques that they used. Hmm. So, you know, a lot of the bands were in awe of Kiss just from their sheer marketing aspect, because they were the first band to really go full out marketing since the Beatles, really.
Right, yeah.
So, that, or Alice Cooper or whatever, but so a lot of bands were curious about that. You know, they were curious about the whole operation and how it worked, you know, and they could see it was a well-oiled oiled machine, and they could see it was like a bulldozer. I mean, Kiss was like a bulldozer. So those other bands that just, you know, didn't have makeup and costumes and stuff, and they just had their amps, you know, this was pretty intense for them, you know?
Yeah.
So, on the good note, one of the my favorite bands and one of the nicest guys of all time was Rush. And they got along great with Kiss. They got along great with them. Geddy was a great guy. They're all great guys. And they had a great time. I mean, they would come out on stage. Rush would come out and throw pies at the end of the tour. They'd throw a pie in Dean's face and shit like that, you know. And Kiss wouldn't let anybody do that kind of stuff unless they really liked them, you know.
Right. Oh, man. I heard some rumor about Rush, like, throwing a bunch of marbles out on stage. Is that true?
No, it wasn't Rush, but I can tell you that story. That was in Gothenburg, Sweden, and the European tour, which was a grueling tour. But anyway, we got to Sweden, and we were playing this ice rink, and they'd block the stage off halfway. They put the stage halfway and to one end of the thing, and they put a big curtain across it because they didn't sell enough seats, right? And I don't know what the security, it's like they had no security at this place. People were sneaking six packs of beer in, I mean, drugs, everything you can think of. And they had folding metal chairs with the metal legs and everything, right? Yeah. And it was set up with boards on top of an ice hockey rink. So it was cold as hell in there. But anyway, some idiot brought ball bearings. He brought a sack of ball bearings, like pretty good size, marble size board ball bearings.
Oh,
all right.
Shit.
The crowd was so rowdy and so drunk. It's like the whole crowd had just come from happy hour. It was incredible. We could see it. It was like, you know, how if you're in a bar or something like that, how you can feel the energy, like there's something going to happen. Something's going to happen. Well, uh-huh. You can feel it. And so the band comes on stage, and about the second song, this idiot throws those ball bearings up on stage. And Paul is shitting his pants because he's got, you know, they got them 7-inch platforms, right? You step on one of those ball bearings with those platforms, he could have killed himself.
Right.
And then some idiot takes a chair and is bending the leg off of it. He bends the leg off of it and throws that up and hits Peter's drums. Like
like
one of the legs with a sharp end on it and hit Peter's drums. Another guy threw a chair up on stage. So by the third song, the band walked off. They said, fuck this. We're not doing this.
Yeah.
Wow. What a crazy show.
Oh, man. My God. It was unbelievable. It was unbelievable.
I think you were working for them. There was a story that they would mention in interviews about they were playing somewhere down south and somebody hurled like an M80 up on stage and hit Peter right in the face with it. Do you remember this?
That was before. I think that was before me. I don't remember.
Oh, was it? Oh, okay. You were there for the Lakeland, Florida show where Ace got shocked, though,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I was. I was. I ran up on the platform and came from that side. Chuck went up the front to get him. And then we brought him backstage and put him in a chair, and he just sat there for about 2 minutes. And we didn't know what was going to happen, whether he was going to have to, you know, not do it or not. Well, it turned out it was a trip light. One of the police lights was wired, and it touched the fog machine. We had these old handmade fog machines that we made out of 55-gallon drums. Mm-hmm. And we put the heating element in the bottom, and we got dryer hoses and put them on, and then we would had a basket on, and you put dry ice in it, and then you could lower the basket down into the hot water, right? And one of those things, you know, one of the trip wires got touched up against one of those fog machines, and that's what shorted it out, and that's what sent the electricity through there. So yeah, we were pretty freaked out. But he turned around, and after a few minutes, after about, say, 3 to 4 minutes, something like that was all, or about 5 minutes, he goes, I'm going to go back out. And so they went ahead and finished the show.
Wow.
Which was, I thought it, because he was pretty shaken up, you know. Of course, he wrote that song, Shook Me, about that,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's bad.
Yeah, he said he thought he was going to die, he said.
But I got to tell you, most of my stories are about Ace, because Ace was, you know, how do I say it? Very colorful. Very, very street savvy, street smart, you know, what you see is what you get, you know. Had all the same friends that he had growing up, and they were still his friends. All the same friends came around, you know. He just was Ace was Ace. But let me tell you a really good story. When we were in that town in Gothenburg, Sweden, the day we got in, we got in early, and it's kind of like a mini San Francisco. It had a trolley car going up the middle of it. It had a street going down. There was this fancy restaurant down at the bottom of this one street close to our hotel. And we pulled in. The band got in earlier because they flew, and we got in about 5 o'clock that night. And as we're driving into the hotel with the bus we were on, we look out and we see Ace walking up the street. He's walking up the hill, up the side of the street, barefoot, with a bottle of champagne in his hand. Right?
Yeah.
He's barefoot with a bottle of champagne at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. You got to get that picture. So Hawkeye and I look at each other and go, oh, my God, what the hell is going on? You know, because first of all, he shouldn't be without his security guy, which at that time was Doberman, you know, Rick. Anyway, yeah, Rick Stewart. He shouldn't have been without him or Big John or somebody. And he was barefoot and his pants were rolled up like, you know, like Tom Sawyer thing.
Yeah.
And so I go, Hawkeye, we got to get up. So I had the bus driver stop. I said, we got to go see what the fuck's going on. There's something going on. He's by himself and he's barefoot. So Hawkeye and I run over to him and we go, hey, what's happening? He goes, hey, Curly, what's up? He goes, come on, let's go get a drink, like that. We go, okay. So we go around the corner and we go into this bar, and then we get him then to tell us what's going on. I said, what's going on? And he goes, I didn't like that restaurant we were in, right? Well, he wouldn't tell us exactly what happened. So he goes, but let's go back to the hotel, and can I stay in your room for a while? No. Why would he ask if he could hang out in our room for a while, right?
He's in trouble.
Yeah.
Unless he was hiding from someone. So we go, sure. So we go back to the hotel, and it's one of these older type of hotels with the awning, the green awning out front, you know, and you can look out the window and see the street with the truck car and everything. And so I go, what's going on? We get to the room. I said, what's going on? And then all of a sudden the phone rings and it's Rick Stewart. We called him Doberman. And he goes, have you seen Ace? And Ace is shaking his head like, don't tell him. But Hawkeye said, no, tell him you just saw him out front. And I said, okay. So I said, well, you know what? Hawkeye said he just saw him out front jump on the back of that trolley car, and he was heading up the street. So we see Rick run out the front door under the green awning and run up the street after the trolley car looking for Ace. But Ace was in our room, right? It was too funny. Anyway,
what was he in trouble for? What did he do?
Why was he barefoot?
Well, okay. So now here's the kicker. In the restaurant, it had a like a pond in the center of the restaurant with a wall around the pond about like a pool, but it was about a foot and a half high. And in the center of the pond, it was round, and there were tables all the way around it, and there was a bar on one side of it, and they had these electronic remote-controlled boats. And so you would send your drink, or you'd write your drink order on a piece of paper, and you'd send the boat over to the bartender, and he'd make the drink, put it in the boat, and you had a controller at your table, and you would, you know, guide the boat back to your table.
Cool. Well,
Ace, being the gadget master that he was, he had to control the controller. He had to have that. So he was messing around with the controller. But, of course, starts running his ships into other boats and knocking over other people's drinks, right? He guides his boat into somebody else's boat, knocks over the drinks. Finally, he puts the thing down. He takes his shoes off, rolls his pants up, and he gets in the pond. And he goes, hey, it's Godzilla. And he goes over and he grabs one of the boats, picks it up, and dumps all the drinks into the thing. And, of course, man is going crazy. He jumps out of the thing. And I don't know how this happened, but somehow he got away from everybody and got out the door. And that's when we saw him walking up the street.
Wow.
Oh, God.
Hey, Godzilla.
I love Ace Frehley's stories.
Godzilla's delivering your drinks today.
Oh, that's too funny.
Awesome.
Well, you got so many Ace stories. Like, I mean, it's weird to call him your boss, but I mean, you were teching for him and Paul. Like, how demanding was he as far as what he wanted equipment wise and sound wise?
He wasn't demanding. He told me what he wanted and I did what he wanted. I didn't really question it. You know, he had his sound down. He knew exactly how he wanted it and he pretty much kept it the same. He had a couple of guitar pedals, you know, a phaser and we had an Echoplex for that guitar solo. And I used to run that and make it go faster and that during that whole thing. But other than that, his sound was a straight, you know, Les Paul sound through Marshalls. It was that Jimmy Page type thing.
So you say for a while there, you were doing that for Paul too, at the same time. What's the difference between Ace and Paul in that respect?
Well, Ace had a, 100 watt Marshall head and two Marshall cabinets, 410s, or I'm sorry, 412s. And Ace had 200 watt heads and four cabinets. And then, of course, we mic'd Paul's and we mic'd Ace's, one of each of the cabinets, and sent that through the main PA. But taking care of them, really what it entailed was taking care of the guitars and tuning them, restringing them. I put new strings on all of them about every twice a week, pretty much. And making sure, the biggest thing was cleaning the guitars off the next day after a show, because they had grease paint on them. They had makeup. They had sweat. They had smoke. You know, everything you can think of. They had confetti on them. So we'd have to clean the guitars really good.
Wow. Right. You know, the next day, think about that stuff.
No, you don't think about it unless you're in the middle of it. But there's so much going on that stage. I mean, between the bombs and the fire and the confetti cannons and all the different stuff back then that we had going on.
Yeah,
It just got bigger and bigger.
Yeah, I was going to ask, because like when you came on board, they were still using what we refer to as the Alive stage setup, which was pretty bare bones, but with, you know, the candelabra, yeah, this wall of amps, but. And then you go to the Destroyer tour comes along, and it's like a quantum leap forward as far as stage production goes, where, like, because even if you see photos of the Destroyer stage from above, there was a lot more going on with that stage than people in the crowd even saw, because even the floor had different design and stuff on it. And I saw pictures of like the amps behind Ace, like there was parts where the wall in front of the amps would or the amps would explode. Do you remember all this stuff?
Well, yeah, I had to load that amp up every day. I had to put it back in. It had a hydraulic pressures on it. Had a hydraulic on it, and then the speakers were tied to this hydraulic thing. And what I could do is just push the button at a certain point in a song, you know, whatever. I don't even remember what song it was, but I pushed the button, and the speakers would fly out of the amp,
nice,
onto the stage. It was great.
That is cool.
Yeah, but. Let me tell you about the Destroyer thing. That was that the Destroyer tour marked a lot of it marked a lot of firsts. We went from two semis at that point and two buses, I guess, to eight semis and three buses. So it was a big shift in the size of the show, and there was something like 50 people on tour. We had two scenery trucks to start off with, And it took to set Destroyer up, I think the first one was Richmond, Virginia, the first show. And it took us 3 days. We had to cancel the show and postpone the show because it took 3 days to set the whole thing up.
Oh, wow.
There was just so much moving parts, so many moving parts to that scenery. I mean, they had two carpenters on the road, for Christ's sakes. Who does that?
And that was like a Broadway show.
Yeah, it was. It really was. And, you know, the makeup thing, and I always felt that way because a lot of the makeup artists that we had were, you know, had to work Broadway. You know, they'd worked that, the whole Broadway scene. But anyway, so Destroyer was really what marked, and I was in for the recordings of Destroyer as well. I was there the whole time they recorded that album. And
Wow.
Yeah, that was pretty intense. Bob Ezrin was a really good producer.
Yeah, there's a lot of stories about the making of that record about how Ezrin was pretty demanding, would push them beyond what they were comfortable doing most of the time. And also the story about, you know, Peter stating that they were, and if you were there, were you there for the recording of Beth? Because Peter talks about how Paul and Gene were kind of mocking him through the recording of that song.
Yeah, they didn't, Gene hated that song. First of all, Gene had a real aversion to them doing a slow song. And when they started to rehearse it, and this is how it became a thing where Peter came out on a stool and sang, was because Gene didn't want to stand there and play a slow song on the bass. He goes, what am I supposed to do? Hang out by this tree back here? You know, look like a jazz player?
Yeah.
You know, he did not like that idea at all. He thought that was totally out of character, and he didn't think they should do a slow song, period. He didn't think Kiss was about that. He didn't think they should do a slow song. And so that's kind of how that happened. But I was there when Peter walked in the studio that day, and Bob Ezrin was sitting at a piano, and Peter was whistling the tune. Peter was just whistling the melody for it. And Bob says, what are you whistling? He goes, oh, it's just this idea I had this morning. And he goes, well, whistle that. Let me see if I can find the chords. So Bob, you know, plucked out some chords on the piano to it. And that's how that song came about.
Wow.
And then there was another time where Bob had Gene and Paul come over to his house because they needed one more song for the Destroyer album. And he goes, well, we got to write a song. So why don't you guys come over tomorrow morning? And so I had to bring guitars over to Ezrin's house, and it was just Gene and Paul and Ezrin and me. And I sat there, and they wrote King of the Nighttime World.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really cool. I was in awe. I was like, you know, I just was drinking it in because I was there. I was part of it.
You had a front row seat to everything exploding. So as a member of the staff work for this band, I mean, were you as blown away as everybody else by how quickly it blew up?
You know what? I always use the analogy that it was like launching a ship from, you know, launching a spaceship from Kennedy Space Center. You know, it was like being on a rocket ride. And it was like the band, especially during the Destroyer thing, because, you know, when I started, it wasn't that big a deal. It didn't feel like that big a deal. But all of a sudden, within a year's time, Destroyer came out. And all of a sudden, it just took off, okay? And it was big. And you could feel it. You could feel the energy behind it. You could feel the motion, the momentum going on. And you knew something big was going to happen. Then, of course, Kiss Alive 2 all of that. Love Gun, and I was in on that one, and Rock and Roll Over, and Kiss Alive 2.
So when you're getting to be that Go part ahead. Of the era of Kiss, where you're talking about like Love Gun and Kiss Alive 2, are you privy to any of their conversations that would eventually lead to the solo albums?
Yeah. Well, what happened on the solo albums was they were working on them individually on their own. You know, each guy was working on his own songs for those albums. And so they weren't really sharing them with each other, you know, and I never saw them really sharing them with each other.
Yeah.
Until the albums. I wasn't in on any of the recordings of them. So they must have done them, I don't know, periodically over time. I don't know how they did that, to be honest with you.
But I guess what I'm asking is, you know, you're there with them all the time when they're out on tour. I mean, what kind of stuff leads to that decision being made? Because what other bands have done that? You know, say, oh, we're going to take a break. We're each going to put out our own album, then we're going to get back together. Mm-hmm. Where does that even begin?
Well, a lot of that stuff came from Bill Acoin, their manager. I think that was his idea to do the solo albums. Hmm. I'm not really sure whose original idea it was, but I'm sure a lot of the big ideas came from Paul, Gene, and Bill Acoin.
Through Kiss fans, like, it's one of those things where Gene and Paul have kind of changed their stories over the years as far as what led to what and what happened. But there's always been discussion about, like, one story that they liked to talk about for years was that the band, when they did Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park, when they were on the set, Ace and Peter both were, like, super unhappy, and especially Ace, and said that they wanted to leave the band. And that Gene and Paul and Bill Acoin were like, well, why don't we just you make a solo album, we'll all make solo albums. Do you think that's the truth, or do you think that was kind of a PR line?
Probably. I was with Ace that day, and I'd left the band and started my own band in Utah, but we went down for that show and we hung out with him, and I was hanging out with Ace that day, and he was pretty upset. He got pretty drunk and, you know, pretty stoned. Because if you watch Kiss Meets the Phantom, he was pretty out of it on that in that movie. I mean, he was pretty buzzed, and there was definitely some shit going on there between them. Yeah. Gene didn't like the fact that Ace drank. You know, Gene. I mean, we made a bet with Gene one time. I think it was on. It might have been. I forget what album it was now. Oh, we said if one of your songs makes the top 10, you got to go out and get drunk with us, because he never drank.
Right.
He never drank. And he goes, okay, I will. Right? And I think it was Christine 16 or one of those songs. I don't even remember which one it was now. And it went into, I think it was number 9 or something like that. And we said, come on, Gene, you got to go get drunk with us. Well, he wouldn't. He chickened out on that. So I never ever saw him drink or do drugs. So he hated the fact that Ace would get drunk and, you know, he would mess up. Ace would mess up sometimes, but most of the time he couldn't tell. It was so loud. I mean, it was hard to tell. Occasionally he'd be out of tune stuff, but most of the time it didn't matter because the songs were pretty basic anyway. At their core, they were the foundation was pretty basic at the core. You know, so he hated that, and Paul and him were real tight. And then Peter was kind of I don't know how to say this. He was not a very strong-willed individual. He kind of let them dominate him a lot, and he complained quite a bit sometimes. But
yeah,
you know. I thought he was the best drummer for the band. I thought he was the perfect drummer for the band myself. Mm-hmm. I thought he was, you know, he's not the greatest drummer in the world, but he was perfect for that band, I thought.
Yeah. Yeah,
just like Charlie Watts for the Stones, you know?
Yep.
So they were definitely thinking about replacing him. Now, I do know this. The band that I was in Chicago was called Lois Lane. And we were working on trying to get a record deal. We did all original music. We were kind of like Styx in Boston and Foreigner, that style of stuff. And we played all over Chicago, all over the Midwest. And one night we were playing at the Thirsty Whale in Chicago, and I got a phone call. The manager came up and said, hey, there's a guy on the phone named Paul Stanley wants to talk to you. And I said, okay. So I went down to his office, because that was before cell phones, of course, guys, right? Yeah. So I went down to the guy's office, and it was Paul. And he goes, hey, Barry, how's it going? And I'm like, yeah, it's going fine. I go, what's up, man? I said, why are you calling me at the Thirsty Whale in Chicago on a Tuesday night? And he goes, well, I just want to be up front with you. I want to be up front with you because I didn't want to go behind your back, but we want to audition your drummer. And I said, okay. I said, well, how do you know about him? And he goes, well, see, Ace had seen our drummer, and so had Fritz and Big John, and somebody else had seen our drummer, and he was an incredible drummer. He actually set his drums on fire. He did a whole fire solo that people would come just to see him do his fire solo. Nice. Anyway, it would have been perfect drummer for Kiss. I mean, you couldn't have picked a better drummer. If you're going to replace Peter, you replace him with this guy that sets his drums on fire, right?
Yeah.
So I give Bill Paul's number, and Bill calls him and talks to Paul, and they were going to fly him out to audition. They were going to fly him out, put him up in the Waldorf or something like that, and the first year he would have made $600,000, a penthouse apartment, and a new car. And that's exactly what was the guy that first guy
Eric
got?
Eric Carr.
That's exactly what he got.
So this was around that time, like 1980.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it was right before that. It was right. Yeah, exactly. Because they called before they got Eric. Before they tried him, they were going to try Bill, and they only had a list of about. Fritz told me later that, and Fritz was one of the ones. Fritz and Ace told him about our drummer Bill Gent. So I told Bill, I said, Bill said, what should I do, you know, I mean, God, I said, Bill, for God's sake, there's the only thing you can do is go audition, because even if you don't get the gig, you can say I auditioned for Kiss. For God's sake, that's like, you know, you got to do it. He goes, yeah, but what about our band? I'm going to ruin our band. I said, don't worry about that. If you get in Kiss, you can help our band down the road. That's all. The only thing you got to know, just go do it. Don't think about it. Just go do it. And he turned it down because our singer intimidated him. Right now, fast forward a couple of years later, whenever it was they replaced Ace, I get another phone call from Paul. And Paul goes, hey, man, we want to audition your guitar player. I'm like, what? He goes, yeah, we heard about your guitar player. So I said, okay. Well, so I gave John Werner a call. Now, John Werner was an incredible guitar player. He played with all of his friends were Quiet Riot, Frankie Benelli. He grew up with him. He played on David Foster's first album. You know, the producer, David Foster, he played on his first album. Yeah, and when he was 15, he played on lead guitar on this album for David Foster. So, you know, John was an incredible guitar player. So they sent him a ticket for, you know, gave him, flew him from Salt Lake to L.A., put him up in a hotel. And I forget how much. They gave him some money, $500 or something. And then they had him come down to this rehearsal studio. So he came down to the rehearsal studio, and he jammed with Paul and Gene. And I think Eric was there at that time. I don't remember for sure.
He was, yeah.
And played for like 2.5 hours with him. And Paul really liked him, but Gene didn't. And John had blonde hair, so that was really a kind of a – at that time – They wanted somebody. He was tall enough. He definitely had looked the part, and he was incredible. It was like a Jimmy Page, Paul Kossoff type of guitar player. You know, Bad Company. Just was perfect guitar player for it. I mean, he could play actually lead guitar wise. He could play Rings Around Ace. Okay, but he also had that Bad Company type of rock feel to his playing. So anyway, he auditioned, and Gene didn't want to go for it. Paul liked him, Gene didn't, so he didn't get the gig. So,
wow.
If you want to go on YouTube, there's a couple of songs. It's called Lois Lane. It's called It Only Takes a Minute. Look up It Only Takes a Minute by Lois Lane. It'll come up on YouTube, and there's a few other songs on there. I think there's 4 or 5 songs on there.
That's cool. You'll get to hear that.
You'll get to hear the drums. And I think we recorded that in 79. I believe 79 or 80. Something like that.
That's cool.
Let me ask you this.
The band was really good. Go ahead.
I didn't
get off on that, but I thought you'd find it interesting.
No, it's super interesting.
Yeah.
Action.
That's super interesting, especially
because we're both a little obsessive about that era of when Ace was getting replaced. Because, well, we have a history with Vinnie Vincent, but I'll tell you about that sometime other. But when Destroyer Tour starts, that's like when things start really blowing up. Beth becomes a hit. They start becoming, instead of just a cult like band with basically an older teen audience, they become an international thing. And yep. One of the big shows on that tour was the Anaheim Stadium show. And
oh god,
I'd love to hear your memories of that, because that was a huge show for the band.
I have a great memory of that, that I think you guys will appreciate. But when we got to the Anaheim show, that was the biggest crowd attendance that they'd had to date. Okay, it was 45,000 people in that stadium, and I went to get. For some reason, I had to go to the hotel to get the guitars, and because they were playing, they were practicing or something at the hotel, so I had to go in a limo and get the guitars and get them. And I came back with Gene and Paul, and we got it. We pulled into the backstage area, and it was like, you know, the typical Hollywood backstage with all the trailers and, you know, ping pong tables and all kinds of shit back there, right? And we pull up in the cars, and you can see the stadium from where we're at, and you can see the crowd. And the Gene and Paul got out of the car, and they just stood there, like in amazement, and they were just staring at how big that crowd was. And Paul goes, "Man, look how many people are out there." So it was like up to that point, that was the most people they'd ever played to.
Wow.
I mean, Flo and Eddie, Seeger, Ted Nugent, yeah.
There's some great footage of that show, but I can't imagine being there, because it was that had to have been a very landmark experience for everybody that was involved with that show.
Well, it was, and Fanfare and Hot Sam, man, they had one hell of a PA setup for that show, and the sound was awesome. But, you know, the funny thing was, when they started the show, you know, and they come running down the stairs, right? Gene come running down the stairs. They had the fog going off, right? Well, Gene fell, and in the video, Gene fell, and it looked like he kept running down more stairs, because he just completely disappeared, and all of a sudden he popped up out of the fog, because he actually fell down the stairs. But you couldn't tell that on. It just, and I'm sure the crowd didn't see it either. It just looked like, you know, if somebody's running down the stairs and they just keep going into the basement, yeah. That's kind of what it looked like.
Wow.
And all of a sudden he popped up and there he was again. It was great.
And think about stuff like that. I mean, Kiss is a band that the live experience, there's so many moving parts. In your adventures with Kiss, you know, I got to imagine stuff went wrong sometimes. What was your biggest oh shit moment in trying to produce a live Kiss event?
Well, one comes to mind, one big one, and that was LA Forum, which is now the Staples Center. First time we went there on tour was, I guess, 75. I don't remember the date. It's just, you know, you guys could probably look this up. Anyway, the first time we were there, they played five nights in a row, and 17,000 people each night. They played five nights. We set up once, and then we didn't have to tear down till the last night. So it was incredible. So we set up, and I think it was the first night. I don't remember which night it was, but anyway. So the stage came. It was a round railing around the back of the stage, and the stage touched the corner of the stage. Just touched right up against it. So then they sold seats behind the stage for some reason. I didn't never understood this, but for some reason they went ahead and sold seats behind the stage. So now usually Dove stayed on one side, like over by me, and Big John stayed over by Gene on that side of the stage. Well, the show starts, right? And I guess about, maybe second or third song into it, some kid decides he's going to jump on stage and he's going to grab a guitar. So he jumps over that railing, jumps right on the corner of the stage, and takes off across the back of the amp line. And John, Big John sees him. Now, John is barreling down behind this guy, and he's a big guy, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not a lot of room back there between the light stands and the drum riser and the bass amps and all the cords and the fog machines. There's all kinds of shit to trip over. So Big John's running towards my side of the stage from Gene's side from in the back, chasing this kid. And this kid's running as fast as he can towards the guitars. And I was coming around just in time to see this happening. I poke my head around, and I see John coming. I see this kid coming, and he either is going to crash into the guitar. John's going to tackle this guy. You can tell he's just going to tackle him no matter what. And he's either going to crash into the guitars or he's going to crash into the amps. Thank God he chose the amps. He tackled that kid into the back of all those Marshall stacks, and they all freaking came down.
Oh, no.
They all fell down. Like building blocks fell down on the stage, cord snapped off, both Paul and Ace's guitars went out, and Big John grabs this guy, picks him up, hauls him down. Thank God they didn't hit the guitars, because if they hit the guitars, those were sitting on the back of the stage, they would have went off the back of the stage. I don't know what would have happened. Anyway, Ace just casually grabs his guitar cord and kind of saunters in his way that he walks across the stage, and he tries to plug into Gene's bass amp so he can keep playing, right? And Gene sees him do it, so Gene chases him away. He like literally does this monster thing and chases Ace away. Well, by the time Ace got back to the other side of the stage, I had hooked one head up and one cabinet. So I had one head, one cabinet, threw the microphone on it for the PA, so Ace was hooked up. And then we hooked up Paul's. We got a cabinet and a head and for Paul hooked up. And then Hawkeye and I and everybody pitched in, and we got the whole stack set back up. But that was pretty intense.
I guess.
Whew.
Oh, wow.
The excitement that comes with a job like that. I love it.
Yeah. Well, let me propose a two-part question. So Gene is well known for knowing that he's bedded down over 4,600 women. A, do you think that's true from what you've seen? And B, did the crew get to enjoy the benefits of Gene Simmons with the groupies as well?
Well, do you have about 3 hours?
We do now.
I've got plenty of time.
I can tell you this. I don't know about the actual numbers, but yes, it's true. And yeah. Jeez, I'll give you a story about that. He, one of the tours, and here again, I don't remember which one, he used to take Polaroids of all of the girls.
Right.
And he would do this. He would try to score a stewardess, if they happened to be going to the same hotel they were going in. He'd try to score them and get them, you know, lay them, you know, before soundcheck. Then he'd try to pick up a girl at soundcheck that was hanging out, bring her back, do her, come back to the show. And then he had Eddie Belandis, the security guy, he'd have him, he would look for girls in the audience that he wanted to be with, and he would have Eddie go tell them what hotel they were in and to come down and wait in the lobby. So then when they would get back to the hotel, he would send Eddie down to get a girl. And so Eddie would come down and get a girl and take her up to the room, and then as soon as that he was done with that girl, then Eddie would take that girl out the back door and he'd go get another girl and bring her up.
Wow.
I've seen it happen. So
that's
yeah, the numbers
right
are
there.
I mean, the numbers are there, but well, I'll be nice. I won't say some of the stuff I know. But anyway, so we got to the end of that tour, and he did he had some videos. He bought a black and white video camera, and he sent this. Oh, it's when we hit L.A. for those shows I told you about where the marshals came down.
Uh-huh.
He sent around an invitation to everybody on the crew to come to his hotel to see the screening of what he called, his title was Common Sluts.
Oh, no.
Now, you know, an invitation, a paper invitation to come and see the screening of Common Sluts. Hey, we were in L.A., and we were we were there for 5 days. The last thing we wanted to do was go to fucking Gene's room and look at all the girls that he had screwed that tour. You know, we wanted to get our own women, you know?
Golly, he must have been proud of it, though.
Although I've heard it was a quantity over quality thing. Is that true?
Yeah. Here's a great story. We're in that hotel in Seattle, that round one that's on the bay. It was the one where Led Zeppelin stayed.
Edgewater.
Yes, yeah.
Well, the Edgewater Hotel, that was there's a story that Ace was would glued all of his furniture to the ceiling. Is that true?
No, that was in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I was there for that. Well, that's one of my best stories. You want to hear it?
Yes, please.
Yes.
Okay. Fritz Postlewaite, the sound man, monitor maker, decided for that tour that he would bring a chainsaw on the road. Now, what use would a roadie have for a chainsaw on the road with a rock band? Right?
Right. Yeah.
Well,
I don't know.
I was rooming with Fritz, and we were staying it was a Sheraton hotel, and we were on about the 10th or 11th floor of this hotel in Tulsa. And we had the day off, and the band and everybody was on the same floor, which never usually happened, but for some reason it did this time. And Fritz, we were sitting there, and the phone rings, and it's Ace, and Ace goes, "Hey, is Fritz there?" And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Is it true that he brought a chainsaw with him on the road?" And I said, "Well, let me let you talk to him." So I gave the phone to Fritz. And Fritz says, "Hey, Fritz, let me borrow your chainsaw." Now, I don't know what possessed Fritz to actually give him the chainsaw.
Yeah, it's not a good idea.
No.
You give a drunk musician on his day off drinking champagne a fucking chainsaw in his room. It can only lead to disaster, you know? So he had a 100-foot extension cord because they didn't have the gas kind back then. So he takes the cord and the chainsaw, and Ace opens the door, grabs the chainsaw, shuts the door, and throws all the locks on them. You can hear the locks closing, you know, as he shuts the door. I'm like, "Oh, God, Fritz, what have you done, man?" I said, "What have you done? You didn't have to tell him you had that. You could have said, 'No, that was a story. Why'd you give that to him?'" He goes, "I want to see what he does." Fritz is like, "I want to see what he does." I'm like, "Oh, shit." So not very long later, all of a sudden, you can hear this chainsaw all the way down the hall. Uh-huh. I mean, it's so friggin' loud, right? People are sticking their heads out of the room, out of their doors, and going, "What's going on?" Right? All of a sudden, I see Big John run down the hallway. He's pounding on Ace's door. "Ace, what the fuck?" All of a sudden, the manager's there. Now we've got about five or six people outside of Ace's door. They're pounding on the door. And meantime, the and you know he's sawing furniture up. I mean, you can hear it, right?
Yeah.
We can all out there. We're all standing outside the door. We can all hear it. And we're all looking at each other and holding our heads and going, "Oh my God." And all of a sudden it stops. And Big John pounds on the door, "Open the goddamn door now, Ace." So Ace opens it. You hear the latches get unhooked on the door, right? Two or three latches. And he slowly opens the door and he goes, "Come on in." And we kind of sneak in. I mean, we kind of walk in very slowly because we don't know what we're going to see. And as we're walking in, all of the furniture is, all the legs are cut off all the furniture, the tables, the chairs, the dresser, and it's all put back where it's supposed to be. Okay. And he gathered all the legs up and threw them over the balcony out into the parking lot. So he kind of cleaned it all up and put all the stuff back, and he just looked at us and goes, somebody said, what were you thinking? And he goes, I was feeling a little Japanese.
Oh, geez. You know what
I mean? I was feeling a little Japanese. So I thought I'd cut everything down to size. We're dumbfounded, like, oh my God, what's going through your mind? Anyway, I forget how much that cost him. It was several thousand. Yeah.
Golly.
And we got banned from Sheraton hotels for that one.
There is truly no one like Ace Frehley.
No, there isn't. And it's funny because I have a ton of stories about him, and I know the one about the fishing thing in Seattle, but I have a ton of stories about him, but not any of about Paul. And I was thinking about that today. I'm going, and I did an interview with John Hart and Tony Mann, and I was thinking, I couldn't think of many stories to tell about Paul that would be the sort of thing that people would really, you know, want to hear as far as, you know, extracurricular, you know, mm-hmm. offstage activities.
He seemed like he was always pretty well behaved. But I mean, we had Tom Harper on, who was Paul's tech on the Dynasty Tour, and Tom mentioned that Paul could be kind of sensitive and hard to deal with at times. Did you have to deal with that?
Yeah, but I didn't really have a problem. I didn't really have much of a problem because I realized that all I had to do was do what they wanted,
yeah.
and then everything would take care of itself. So with Paul, I just played the game with him. I just played his tech, and I was real nice to him, and whatever he asked me to do, I did, and I just didn't bitch about it. Wow. So that paid off because at the end of the Destroyer tour, he walked out on stage on the last show, and he handed me a check for $1,000, you know, from Paul Stanley for $1,000. So
that's cool.
He must have liked
it. That's good. Mm-hmm. But like, so I mean, as they got bigger and bigger over the years, did you notice the division between Paul and Gene and Ace and Peter because of, you know, the excesses?
Yeah. Well, you know, there's endless stories about what fame does to people. You know, basically fame, either you reach a point where you want to have time to yourself and you don't want all of that fanfare, or you eat it up like Gene does, Gene and Paul. They love the fanfare. Peter didn't care. And Ace didn't care about all of that. Peter yeah. and Paul loved playing rock star. They loved it. I mean, you know, that's who they were. But Peter and Ace, it wouldn't have mattered if he was in KISS or if he was in some local band in upstate New York. He would have still been the same guy. He would have still done the same things. That's kind of why I like him so much. You know, why I got along. So when we hired Hawkeye to come on later on, I let Hawkeye take care of Paul and I took care of Ace, and it worked out great because Hawkeye's super quiet, super nice guy, really easy to get along with. Everybody loved him, so it was perfect. So he would just take care of Paul's guitars and I would take care of Ace's. It was a pretty easy gig, actually.
Yeah.
Man, that's cool.
Well, one thing I got to add, because I noticed on your Facebook page, you've got these photos of the band not wearing makeup, but wearing dresses. Can you explain what the hell's going on with those pictures?
Yeah, Gene, when I took those pictures, that was the last show of the Kiss Alive 2 tour, and it was in Dallas, Fort Worth, and they did, I think, two nights there, and Styx opened up those shows, and there was a big backstage area with a lot of people backstage, I think because it was the last shows of the tour. The trucks, we had parked all the trucks and the buses and everything behind the stage. It was amazing. I've never seen anything quite like it. And so on the way to sound check, on the last day, Paul decided they drove by some dress shop or something, and Paul said, hey, let's go into the store and let's get some dresses and dress up like women and show up, arrive at the gig in dresses, right? Just to fuck with the crew. It was about fucking with the crew. And it wasn't about anything else. It was about doing silly at the end of the tour, because it's always a tradition to do something crazy on the last show of a tour.
Yeah.
It's always been like, something crazy. And so they did, and they arrived with those outfits on. But nobody had cameras except for me and Eddie, and I think Lydia was there, and I think she had a camera, but yeah, just me and Eddie that I knew of, Eddie Belandis, that had cameras. And I always carried my this Kodak Instamatic. I had it on a little pouch, and I had it on my belt because, hey, I knew someday I was going to regret it if I didn't have pictures of some of this. So I took pictures of them. They let me take pictures of them, which was unusual. And when I took a picture of Gene, that one I have of Gene, and he goes, I better never see this picture in a magazine. I said, you don't have to worry about it, Gene. You know, I got offered $5,000 for those at one time.
Wow. Oh, I bet.
You know, I could have sold them. I could have sold them, but I think I posted them out maybe a year, 2 years ago. It was the first time I ever put them on Facebook. But I figured at this point it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
But right. Back then, they went without makeup, in dresses. Are you kidding me? I could have got a lot of money for that.
Oh, sure.
So how many photos of the band from those backstage, you know, back scene kind of stuff, how much of that do you have now?
Oh, I don't have a lot. I have a few things now. I used to have a lot. I'd have to really look. I got some stuff.
Because, man, I know the fans nowadays just love, I know I personally love to see the candid stuff from back when, you know, you weren't, like you said, people didn't take pictures of Kiss without their makeup. So, you know, that's a pretty rare thing to have candid, with a K, photos of Kiss from back in that era. Yeah. It's awesome. I'd love to see that stuff.
Well, I got one of Ace that you'll like. I'll send it to you when I'm done, of the Rubber Raft story, where he called me up one day, and you know Bobby McAdams?
Yeah.
You heard that name?
Sure.
Best buddy. Well, he called me up, and this was after the Destroyer tour, and they got all that money. Ace, first thing Ace did was he went out and bought all kinds of shit, clothes, boots, and he bought a Cadillac, a red Eldorado Cadillac with a white leather top and white leather interior. And so he called me up one day, and he goes, hey, come on up, man. We're gonna do something. I said, well, what are you going to do? And he goes, just come on up, and you'll see. So I came up there, and I pulled up to the driveway, and next to his Cadillac, in the driveway, he's got a Navy SEAL-type gray rubber raft. And him and Bobby are down on the ground trying to blow this rubber raft up. And I'm like, what the hell? What are you guys doing? And they're like, hey, come on, man. We're going to blow this raft up, and then we're going to take it out. I said, okay. So I helped him, and we got the raft all blown up, and he had like a 15-horsepower motor, and we put it on the top of his Eldorado and tied it down.
Oh, wow.
And I thought we were going to go to a little lake somewhere, right? You know where we went?
Hmm.
We went to the Hudson River. It was a little 3-man raft, right? And I go, you got to be kidding me. We're not going to go out in that river. Have you ever seen the Hudson River? It's black with oil. And it's huge. It's wide. It's big, right? And I go, you got to be kidding me. We can't go out there in this raft. He goes, yeah, come on. It'll be fun. So the three of us get in this little, it was really a 2-man raft, but all three of us got in this little raft with a 15-horsepower motor. And we're just going out into the middle of the Hudson River. And sure as shit, here comes a big fucking ocean liner, right? Oh. Down the hut towards us. I'm like, Ace, there's a fucking ocean liner coming at us, man. We got to get out of here. So he turns it around. Now, 15-horsepower motor is not very fast, right?
Especially with three guys in a 2-man boat.
barreling down the river. And we're like, I mean, we had to be a spot on the water to that boat, you know? Anyway, so we made it back safe, obviously.
Oh, shit.
it was little things like that, you know, that he did that was so much fun.
That's awesome.
Oh, man.
What's the nicest thing you've ever seen Ace Frehley do?
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
Because you always hear the stories of his wild man side, you know, and I always like to hear the, like, you know, that the guy did nice things once in a while, too.
I know he took care of his friends. I do know that. I don't know if he I know he took care of Bobby. I think he helped Bobby get a house or apartment or something. And I know he bought stuff for his friends. He used to also, you know, put on parties and pay for everything for the parties and, you know, that kind of thing. He did a lot of nice stuff, but always usually for his friends. I don't know about family and stuff. That pretty much it. He gave me one of those watches that he had, though. That was pretty nice.
Yeah.
Pulsar. It was called Pulsar. Made at Tiffany's, and they're kind of big looking. They're really cool though. And he said he gave me one that said, you know, to Barry Aiken from Ace Frehley, which was great. It was really cool.
Right,
so he did, cool. You know, he was a good guy. And I saw him later on after the, you know, on some of the solo tours. I hooked up with him a couple of times. I'd have to really think about that, but. But well, he was a nice guy. He had a good heart.
How did things end with you and Kiss? Well, do you remember what your last show was and what led to you being done with the band?
Well, what happened was on that last tour, I met this singer in Salt Lake City, and we had a day off, and we talked about, I had thought before that tour that I said, if I'm going to try to make it in my own band, I'm going to have to do it soon. If I don't, I'll end up being a roadie the rest of my life. So I knew that I had to, if I was going to, I had to do something within the next few years. And I ended up meeting a singer out in Salt Lake, and we talked about putting a band together. And so at the end of the tour, which was that time where they dressed up in dresses, that was the last show, we went back, and Eddie Kramer, the producer, did 5 shows with us with a live recording truck, a live recording studio that he had He did Dallas, he did L.A., he did the Budokan in Japan, and one or two other places, can't remember where. And we went back to New York, and everybody else went home. I stayed and went into the studio with those guys to finish Kiss Alive 2, so I just, you know, helped set up the amps and whatever. I took care of everybody at that point, whatever they needed. I'd run out and get food for everybody, but that was great, and I'm glad I did that because I got to hear stories from Eddie Kramer talking about Led Zeppelin and Hendrix, and talk about Hendrix and him built the studio and all kinds of great stories. It was just incredible.
Awesome. So if you were there for those Alive 2, the studio album, the studio tracks, I mean, from your perspective, why was Ace not playing on that stuff? Did he just go home too?
Ace did not like the studio. He did not really care about the studio.
Yeah,
he definitely didn't care about the studio. You know, I noticed that on Destroyer. He just, you know, it was like pulling teeth to get him to come in and do his tracks. You know,
yeah,
he was.
Did so the end of the Alive 2 tour was kind of the last thing you did with them? Is that true?
Yeah,
yeah.
And then I called every one of them up and told them I was leaving when I did after the thing. I had a month off, and I went out to Utah, and we put the band together, and I called them up, each one of them individually, and told them why I was leaving, and so that they wouldn't hear some story at the office or whatever, you know.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I called each one of them up and told them. They were all fine with it. They were all like, yeah, great, you know.
Yeah,
and I think that's why Paul felt like he could call me, you know, and ask me about our drummer and our guitar player.
So how's the band going? Can I have your drummer? How about your guitar player? But that's cool, though. You know, they got to respect that.
I did respect it. I thought it was great that he did that, you know. He must have respected me enough to do that, you know. Because
sure.
Otherwise, he would have just sent somebody out. You know, he could have just sent somebody out to talk to Bill, and that would have been it, you know.
Yeah. Do you stay in touch with any of the old Kiss crew guys?
Yeah, Hawkeye, I saw him, when was it, Dave? January?
Yeah.
December, he's, you know, with Weird Al Yankovic.
Oh, he works for him.
Yeah, he's been working for him for years now. He lives in Minnesota. You know, Hawkeye helped Prince build his studio.
Oh, wow.
Wow. Paisley Park.
Yeah, Minneapolis. He lives in Minneapolis, and after the whole Kiss thing, he went to work for Prince, and he ended up staying with him and helping him build that studio out there.
That's wild.
So, small world, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, Rick Hendrickson.
That's cool. So have you had any contact with the guys from Kiss since you stopped working with them?
Ace, and I saw Gene and Paul about 2 years ago. They actually opened a restaurant where I live in Oviedo, Florida, which is northeast of Orlando. And it's called
Rock and Brew.
What the hell is it? Rock and Brew. And they opened out a couple of years ago. And I got there. I got to talk to Gene for a couple of minutes. But they were leaving, and he looked beat. I mean, he looked worn out. They'd been there all day doing television stuff, and I couldn't get there. I tried to get there as soon as I could. And Paul had just pulled away, so I didn't get to talk to him, but I talked to Gene for a few minutes. That's the last time I saw him. And I seen Ace several years back when he did a solo tour through here. I've seen him a couple of times when he came through.
Oh, that's cool. Do you guys get to catch up?
Yeah, it was good. But, you know, there's a lot of miles down the road between when I was with him.
Yeah.
You know, but we had some good laughs. Ace and I had some good laughs. I told the story about the wireless, about him playing guitar and up on the toilet. Mm-hmm. And I told that story to the band, his band, you know. Oh, God, they were rolling on the floor.
Nice.
And he was looking at me like, he was just looking at me like he didn't remember it, you know. He was looking at me like he was one of the guys hearing the story for the first time.
Yeah, he probably was.
Well, that does sound like something I would do.
Yeah, that's kind of the look he had, you know.
That's awesome.
Well, I have to ask, like, overall, like, when you look back on your time with them, I mean, I know in the middle of it, it's like a whirlwind, but when you look back and you realize that this band has, like, sustained itself for almost 50 years now, I mean, it's got to be pretty awesome to look back on that and realize that you were there for, like, the absolute peak of their powers.
Yeah, it is. It definitely is. Yeah. I had no idea they were going to go this long and this many albums, and, you know, it's amazing. They had an amazing career.
Well, you, and sir, are definitely a part of history, no doubt about it.
A little bit of it, yeah.
Yeah, but still, you are. And this has been awesome today. I feel like we're just scratching the surface with you, man. Would you ever come back on the show with us again sometime?
Sure, no problem.
Man, that'd be great. I'd love that.
Yeah, because I know that we're going to get several listener questions going, how did you not ask him about ABC?
Right, yeah.
You know, so we'll have more questions in the future. But thanks so much for taking the time to do this today.
No problem, man. It's good talking to you guys.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com. Code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.